Hi, I'm Patrick Palm, and this is the Learn from Leaders podcast. In this show, I interview favorite customers and other interesting leaders in product development, marketing, HR, executive management, investors. You find favorite leaders in many different places and in organizations doing game development and publishing, software as a service and other tech companies and big enterprises, you know, going from very centralized command and control kind of organizations to a more modern way of working with a culture with high team autonomy and better alignment towards the company goals and values. So let's go. So on the topic of challenges in the games industry from a production point of view, I think one of the big ones is, you know, moving to basically everything becoming a live service. So, well, firstly, do you think that's true? Is everything becoming a live service? And secondly, what does it mean?
Oh boy, those are huge. The first one, do I think it's true? To an extent, let me try to explain that. I don't think we will see a return to a world where people buy a box product and whatever you get, and there will never be a patch for that. There will never be a bug fix. There's not really any expectation that you'd ever contact the company except via snail mail or email or something like that, giving them your thoughts. We live in a world where even a small indie studio will get massive feedback and players may discover a bug, and they can, and it usually makes sense to fix the most egregious of those bugs if they exist. And the consequence of this is very interesting. Our launch quality standard across the board at every level of studio, from your huge AAAs all the way down to your indies, has been able to go down. And you might do that through early access or through different releases. But even if you just have one launch point, you know that if you did a good job and the game largely works and you've done it a little bit of compatibility testing, you're probably okay to ship. And if you're a huge studio, you've done a ton of those things. But you also know that you're likely to discover something and it's okay, you'll fix it. You didn't used to have that as an option. And so you can go back in time and find horror stories of games being burned onto their CDs, let's say, with a bug in them that prevented some critical part of the experience from happening. And it was a horrific problem. Nowadays, we just don't experience that. And so in the sense that even if you make a single player, one-time playthrough, never going to make an expansion, never going to make a patch, you still have a default player expectation that some amount of support for any sort of egregious bug that pops up exists. And the response to this, doesn't happen in a vacuum. The response to this is studios realizing that the standard no longer has to be perfection. And you could even argue shouldn't be perfection, where before you had to be as darn near close to perfection as you could be because you didn't get another shot. So I'd say that even games that are like, let's take like a Telltale without any sort of expansions or expectation of a sequel or anything, like just a really narrative story, simple, play through it once you're done. I think there's still elements of a live service in that, and you have to figure that out as a studio, because to be playing a game and then to completely shut it down to, like, we turned off the servers, we no longer do support for players if they're playing it, we no longer fix bugs, we no longer do anything. Even smaller games tend to support stuff for some amount of time. Now, is that live service like a World of Warcraft or a Hearthstone or a World of Tanks or something like that? No. And the amount of effort invested is dramatically less. So is everything moving towards a live service? Yes, I think we are there. And that's a player expectation and then a developer response, both involved. I think then let's go into why. Why is everything moving towards live service? So games as a service. A couple things come to mind. One, because we can. Because I can ship something early, get feedback from real players, iterate on it, try something new, iterate some more, try something new, and have that all be something that that relative homogeneity of high-speed internet makes this viable. But it's not a problem. It's not a big deal. You don't have to spend. I remember when it was in the 90s sometime, but we were going to download a video that was like 30 seconds long on a 14.4 modem. And, you know, a little beep, boop, boop, doop, boop, all that stuff that we used to happen. That's, again, it's gone and it's, you know, in the past. And it took us all day to download that 30 second video. And now I can just stream video to my phone wirelessly from almost anywhere. And so the world has changed in terms of its connectivity, and development has responded and player expectation has responded. So that's cool. That allows us to do neat things like early access releases, closed alphas, try stuff out, see what works. And that's actually much easier than it used to be in a lot of ways. I think there's another reason that people are moving to live service that's more of a business, or that they want to move games to live service. And I think this is a deceptive one, actually. If I can create a successful live service game with a reasonable number of engaged players, and reasonable is going to vary depending on the game and how much it costs to make and all this different stuff, that can be the goose that lays the golden egg for my entire studio. And you see that in multiple of the big video game production company studios that are out there. Blizzard released World of Warcraft, and it solved Blizzard's money problem. Did they know it was going to do that? Did they know it was going to become the biggest MMO ever? No, they didn't know. But once it had, it's printing money. It's making them all the money they need to run the entire studio, to run other game development teams, to do all kinds of things. Riot did this with League of Legends. Valve right now has Counter-Strike and Dota. There are other ways that other studios have done this that aren't necessarily purely live service, although some of them have that live service multiplayer component. EA has the sports franchises that make a lot of money. Activision has Call of Duty, right? And obviously now we've got Activision, Call of, like Blizzard, Microsoft, all the combos and everything like that. But there's this idea of, if I can make a game, and if I can make a game that has, a reasonable player base, for some people that might be might be 500 if you're an indie dev or something like that. But, you know, let's say 10,000 or 100,000 or a million people playing this regularly. And I found a way to monetize some percentage of that player base in an ongoing way, then I can now support my entire studio. And that's very appealing. If you can make a successful live service game, you can just sustain indefinitely. The challenge that I see, and the reason I think people got really excited about this, especially after League of Legends free-to-play success in the Western market, that was more common in the Eastern game space, but it wasn't as common in the West. Riot brought that to the West, and now a lot of games try to operate under similar models to that. Like, oh, can we go free-to-play? Can we try free-to-play, see what happens? They're all trying to capitalize on that. The problem, those games are they're usually very time consuming for players. You don't play a ton of that very intensely live service games at the same time. I mean, some people do, but you know, when I remember I was playing a ton of Halo, and then I started playing World of Warcraft, and I started playing less Halo. Because I was playing World of Warcraft and I had a life, you know, I was in college at the time and doing various things, and I couldn't do all the games all the time. And so when you think about the live service games that become ones that people will play for years and years and years and will print money for a studio, you know, like your Counter-Strikes and your World of Tanks and et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot of studios attempting to grab that audience, to grab that type of player who would just will full-time this game as their main game for a very long time. And there's very few successes relatively. There's other things that come up, which is like over time, are you going to continue to appeal to new players? Or are you going to only appeal to people who already like your game? And how much of a problem is that? And all this different stuff. But I think that's why it's so appealing on the product side, on the money side, the business side. The business side is like, dude, if we can set this up, if this, even if I have to take 100 shots at this, if one of them succeeds, it pays for everything forever, you know, practically. And that seems super appealing versus, let's say you're going with more of a, like a Naughty Dog, right? You're producing really compelling narrative, story driven, phenomenal action games, but you have to keep doing that. You have to keep doing it and doing it and you're constantly having to produce more content and new content and new content. And yeah, you have to do that. Like League of Legends produces new content. World of Warcraft has to release an expansion. But there's this weird thing where you already have so much there, and it's the intention of the live service model, especially with something like a Counter-Strike. I mean, how much new content does Counter-Strike produce? Very little relative to so many of these other games. You know, if you look at Counter-Strike over the last 10 years, how much new content has Counter-Strike produced compared to Call of Duty? Almost nothing. And yet, what are they still getting, like over a million CCU peak every day? People love it. And so I think that's it. I think there's a dream there. And so I think that you're often pushed by, if your game can be that sort of live service product, man, why not do that? Why not try to do that, versus create something, you know, that is highly compelling, still has live service components to it. Like let's take an Elden Ring, right? Live service components to it. It's got an expansion that's come out. There's a multiplayer mode. There's a PvP. There's a co-op. There's servers that need to be on. Simpler live service, the value of that game from the publisher's perspective is we made a great game. A lot of people bought it. They bought it. We're not necessarily planning on extensive monetization of them outside of expansions where they buy the new thing because they're so excited to play more of this type of content. And by the way, in Elden Ring case, you see like that worked really well. It was brilliant. You see Black Myth Wukong, similar thing, you know, but they have aspects of live service to how they relate to players and how players relate to the game with some of those multiplayer aspects and things like that. But the value is sort of all up front. You know, you expect to see this huge spike of purchases and then it drop off. And what that means is no matter how much money you made, you have to go make another game. Yeah, or you have to go make an expansion. You have to go continue to make new stuff, which I think that's also true to some extent with Counter-Strike being maybe on the extreme end of didn't really need to make new content. But, you know, I worked on League of Legends for a long time and you're making a lot of stuff all the time. There's a very large development team working very hard to make new champions and new skins and all this different stuff. To actually sustain the fact that you have a live service product. But it's nice because you know the core game is solved. I don't have to resolve that. I get to create cool things that players love and are willing to pay for, but like I get to focus on like players loving it. You know, let me just add a ton of player value into this ecosystem and let the ecosystem respond by giving money back for all the joy that they're getting from this experience. So anyway, it's a very privileged position to be in if you're in that spot where you have a World of Warcraft or a League of Legends or a World of Tanks or a blah, 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 that is printing money for you. And it won't necessarily last forever, but I think they last longer than anybody expected them to. When you look at things like Counter-Strike and World of Warcraft, like these are games that have been around now for 20 years and at longer. I think Counter-Strike hit 25, although not all of that on Steam, but they've been around for a very long time and they've been successful for that long. And that's also a really interesting thing of like, whoa, this stuff, it's not like, you know, television show ran for 6 years, shuts down. Now some of them do, but some of them can really run. And that's also something where man, even if I have a small shot at doing that, wouldn't that be nice? Because that's that, again, that keeps me employed. That allows me to keep doing what I love for a very, very long time. This is kind of a long, rambly answer, but it's a very complicated question. So I think those things, I think the technology allows live service to exist. I think there's a really appealing business case that undervalues the difficulty, because when you go into live service games as your main thing, you are going into a red ocean. I don't care what your genre is, because you're competing with all the other games that are trying to get players to play this as their main game. And there's only so many of those that are going to succeed, because a lot of those are based around the not just the relationship to the game, but the relationship to the other people who play the game. And you need all of that to kind of fit together and work properly. I do think we're going to that live service world. I think more and more we will.
Yeah, and the business promise here, you know, I think you made very clear. Do you, I mean, if we take a little bit longer perspective here, from beginning of League of Legends and forward, I mean, do you feel like the market has delivered on that business promise? Or do you feel like, you know, if you think about this from like an investor point of view, that it has been harder, more challenging than what people expected? Or do you feel like, no, it has exceeded expectations and more money has been made than anyone could ever expect?
I think it's both. I think when you hit it, when something lands, when you get the lightning in the bottle and your game just becomes a game that has hundreds of thousands of people playing it every day, it's mind-boggling how much players are willing to respond because of their enjoyment of the game with their dollars and say, I want to keep playing this. I love this. I want to support this team. I love the stuff you're making me. Thank you for making me awesome skins. Thank you for making me awesome, you know, new, whatever it is that you're monetizing inside of the context of the game. I also think it is way harder than people thought. And this is where I come back to that idea of, this is a red ocean. I don't care what your genre is.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, well, nobody's really hit a good games as a service, you know, RTS, like tactical RTS in the last StarCraft. Let's say StarCraft 2 is the last big shot at that. We'll go make that game, right? It seems like there's not as much crowding in that market. Now, I can talk about the RTS genre, but that's would be a different conversation. I don't care what your genre is. I don't care if you're inventing a new genre. You're needing, if you're banking on it being a success, and I think that's the thing that a lot of people do, is they bank on it being a big success. Then when it's not, when it's only an okay game, or when it's not as successful, it's going to take some more work, you run out of money, or you run out of the ability to raise more money, might be a better way to say it. And so this is the thing, this is the trap. I heard someone describe it as that, like, if you went and raised a bunch of money on a really exciting live service game idea, if you raise too much money, you have to be one of the best games of the year, period, in order to just recoup what you already spent. In order for this thing to feel like it's going to have legs, in order for you to keep getting funding and be able to continue. And this is one of the things that I think is fascinating. When I look at some of those very successful games, there's probably a counterexample to this, but I think humble beginnings is how I would describe it. A lot of the games that nowadays people play as like their main game, even World of Warcraft, right? Because World of Warcraft was coming out at the same time as EverQuest 2 way back in the day, around the same time I think Star Wars Galaxies had dropped. There were other MMOs that were all competing for the same thing, that like UO and EverQuest had kind of proved that, hey, people will actually pay you money month over month to create a product, or to create an MMO that's like a compelling experience. And did Blizzard know that World of Warcraft was going to become the MMO, like the genre, the thing that everybody else tried to kill for the next 20 years whenever they're making an MMO? No, they didn't know that. They had a, compared to today, incredibly small development team. And they you know, they I mean, I'm not saying they had really talented developers, but I think it was like 50 people or something. And they created the genre defining MMO. I think they hope to do that. I doubt they banked on it. And I feel like nowadays a lot of investing and studios are banking on it. Like we have to not just win, we have to win huge or this won't work. And all like Counter-Strike, League of Legends, World of Warcraft, I think the World of Tanks games, that even something like Warframe, these Rainbow Six Siege, these all start small in some ways. Now, different variants of small. And sometimes you see a spike at the beginning and then a drop off. Some of them have more IP behind them or more sort of player goodwill behind the studio or whatever it might be. I think that was a huge thing for World of Warcraft. I think they were one of the only recognized studios out there. Blizzard was one of the only recognized studios way back in the day that really would draw people's attention. It's like, wow, they only produce quality. Let's try this game. And then they did. And it was like, oh, wow, it's actually a really good game. And suddenly, you know, you're off to the races. But even something like CCP and EVE Online, not as well known of a studio, right? But created a game that started small. And I loved watching the growth curve of it, because while all the other MMOs were fighting for millions and millions and millions and whatever, CCP just had this slow increase in players over time. And Rainbow Six, actually, after an initial spike, dropped way down. And then they also did that. They just had this slow increase in players over time until, you know, they were a joke game. And then suddenly they were in this conversation. It's like, no, this is one of the three tax shooters that people will compare to or reference against. It's like Counter-Strike, Valorant, Rainbow Six Siege. And they snuck into that, right? And Counter-Strike also was a mod. And so I think about this, I think about these humble beginnings, and then I go like, can you, especially with your first game of the studios ever made, can you just expect to have this sort of live service scaled game success? I don't think that's a reasonable expectation. I think you should be targeting some level of like, oh, people resonate with this. And then do you just build on it for this is the problem, however long it takes. That's a really bad thing to say to somebody who's looking at this as a short-term or even medium-term investment, part of their investment portfolio, is like, well, what we're going to do is we're going to make something that we think resonates with some subset of players, and then we're going to slowly build on it for however many years it takes for it to become successful. You know, like, okay, VCs are all walking away. That's not totally true. Some are absolutely in for that, I think. But a lot are like, wait, I wanted something that was going to explode and become huge, be the next League of Legends, be the next World of Warcraft.
No, I was just going to say, you know, you mentioned before, you know, underestimating how challenging it is. You know, and you know, when it comes to the production perspective here, and if I, you know, geek out a little bit about organizational psychology, you know, one of the challenges I find very interesting with this is that if you're making one of these games, you know, which is big enough, you know, your, you know, product development team is really going to be a team of teams, and, you know, game development is complex as it is. So there's it's like an exponential complexity there. But then on top of that, you know, in this scenario, you know, if you're releasing all the time and not only releasing new features, you know, new content, you know, there's everything that needs to happen with your marketing around this, you know, your community management, you know, there's a lot going on there. And if you have very frequent releases, it means that, you know, to use the Sam Altman quote, that, you know, your strength as a company is your ability to, you know, iterate, you know, like how fast you can iterate as a company.
Yes.
So, a live service game is almost like a perfect storm of that challenge.
Yes.
Is that also how you see it? And can you speak a little bit to that, if so?
You're talking about like the idea of the necessity of iteration in the live service environment?
Yeah. I mean, I'm thrilled by, you know, the whole kind of perfect storm situation, you know, that's so many, it's not only about like the size that you have, like team of teams. It's also that it's going to be a diverse group of teams. It's not only, you know, different teams working with product.
Right, yeah.
Totally different things. You know, you're introducing live ops, you know, you have community management, you have the marketing. I mean, now, right, you know, with a box product, it was a little bit more linear, you know?
Yes. Yeah. I think, So I think that, yeah, if you had a model for how you developed games, and I still see this quite a bit, and it's the, you know, your sort of classic, hey, ideation, pre-production, production, post-production, launch, and then maybe something like a sustainment or something like that. But when you're a live service game, what is your cycle? And it's like, well, we're constantly running that entire loop inside of every sub product we're building all the time. Inside of a live game that has to stay up all the time. You know, this is one of the things that people will say, like, oh, why does it take so long to do this? Like, why? It's just, we just got to shift this or move this. And it's like, hey, do you realize that in the next day, 100,000 plus people are going to log into this game? And if we more rapidly decide to, we do something unwise that negatively impacts the experience, we didn't just like, oops, I guess we'll iterate on that for next week's playtest, like when you're in dev. You just negatively impacted 100,000 players. Depending on how much you negatively impacted it, some of them might not come back. And I remember talking about, I was actually at Riot. There was a team I moved on to, and they were building a feature. And one of the questions I asked when I got there, and technically I'm an engineer by degree, but I never really did engineering. Like I'm a leader producer. That's my expertise. I couldn't code you a game. I can't mess around very well in Unreal or Unity or anything like that. But I showed up and I asked, like, cool, how do we release this thing? And they didn't really have a strong answer. And some of that was just because where they were at in development, but we were getting to that point where, hey, this is starting to become a real thing that's going to go out and be on millions of players' computers. And I remember talking with one architect about it, and they said, do you realize what you're touching when you touch? Because we were basically touching the base install of the game. He said, if you mess this up, you could brick the League install on who knows how many millions of players' computers. We will not be able to, it would be very difficult for us to fix that. That's why, you know, he was very cautious. He wanted extensive testing. He was like, this is going to take way longer than you're thinking. It's not just about building the feature. It's about making sure that feature doesn't break anything else you've ever built. And I think that stacking complexity of the live environment, and the fact that, you know, there's a lot of times where you're wanting to iterate and you're wanting to experiment, but at what's the cost? You have to be thinking about, if we mess up the player experience and tank our player base, it wasn't worth it. Even if we were like, oh, we learned that doesn't work. So there's this different expectation. Simultaneously, you can't just not do anything, because you have to keep putting out fresh content. You have to keep adding features. Players want them. You want to produce them. You want to keep adding that player value. I think if you do nothing, you will start stagnating eventually. And again, I think the counter example to this is Counter-Strike, where it's almost like, dude, the game's still going. But to be fair, it's gone from, you know, the original Counter-Strike to all the versions, 1.6, to now, you know, Go, and like, it's now Counter-Strike 2. Like it's evolved over time, as they've updated to try to keep it more and more current, to keep it more and more appealing and interesting, but that core game stays the same. And I think that's, so it is a perfect storm, and you're constantly trying to weigh, what am I learning? What's the value I'm producing? What do I need to figure out versus what's the risk I'm taking to my live player base? And again, there's some teams, you're going to have an infrastructure related team that's really focused on this, just the long-term stability and making sure everything's running and it's running and the pings are good and that, you know, the server tick is where it should be, or there's sufficient servers to handle the server tick, perhaps is a better way to put it. Like we're requisitioning enough, and we've got the right services on AWS, and we've got the right services on Metal, and all this different, you're answering all these questions. But your life is around making sure this never goes down. And if it does, we've got backup upon backup upon backup. And then you have a team out there and they're like developing a new part of the game, and their job is to innovate and try new things, but also not break anything that already exists. And that's way easier to accidentally do than you'd think, both on a technical level of like, I wrote some code that didn't play with some of the other code in our code base, or from a gameplay level, I built this cool thing, except now actually the thing that people found fun is not as fun anymore. I made the experience better, but it actually made everything worse somehow. And I have to now puzzle through that in a live environment and figure out, well, wait, how do I even test if I'm correct or if it's something else, because especially if you have, you know, I'll point to League of Legends because I was there. You have hundreds of people on all these different teams building stuff, and every patch you have a whole ton of content going out. You see changes in player numbers. What caused it? You don't know. You have guesses. Players are telling you something, but you don't know exactly. And you have to then try to puzzle through and figure out, how might I test if it's this or that or the other? And is it just a temporary drop, or is it, you know, incidental? Like, you know, you're playing, you're on a live service game, and suddenly some other big product drops that everybody who's a gamer goes and plays. And so you see this huge drop in your CCU and your concurrent users. And you could freak out, or you could be like, well, they're probably just all going and play that other game. And you might be right. What if you're wrong? Well, we kind of expected that. Well, did we expect it this much? Well, we didn't know exactly. Okay. And so there's this never ending. You have to be so humble and so willing to ask questions at every step with every feature, no matter what part of that product you're on. And you're looking at so many more things than you were thinking about when you were just developing the game. There's so much more to be aware of. And that's why those live service teams tend to grow quite a bit, and why there's a whole sub-industry adjacent to games that is providing tools for live service products. That's sort of expanding. It's been expanding for probably the last 10, 15 years. We're just like, hey, we'll solve this problem for you so you don't have to hire a bunch of people to do it. And so many studios are like, oh, thank heavens. Thank heavens you're there to solve that for me.
I hope you liked that interview. If you did, you know what to do. Share it on your favorite social media so others can learn from the Favro community.